So yeah, as I said, I put down a set of questions. I think I would like to start with. I think the order I put them down is kind of in line with how I would like to have this conversation. So the first question is about your career path. If you can present yourselves, and yeah, how you ended up studying the field of research you're studying. If I can ask, I don't know who wants to start, but if you can start both.
You can start with it and then.
So I'll start.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so my background is in statistical physics. So I graduated in Rome and La Sapienza, and with a thesis on self-organized criticality in the group of Luciano Pietronero. So at that time, he was interested in fractal growth phenomena, and that seemed an interesting topic to me. And so this was really prototypical complex systems because we are talking about almost 30 years ago. And so there was a lot of work on these fractal growth phenomena. And the first appearance of this avalanche phenomena, so self-organized criticality and so on. So I did a thesis on that subject. And then I went to Boston University in the group of Gene Stanley, who was also interested in many interdisciplinary applications of statistical physics and complex systems. And I continued working on this topic, let's say crackling noise, avalanches, mostly in material science, so in magnetic systems, in fracture, and also in some more fundamental statistical physics models, so non-equilibrium systems and so on. So this was my background. Then I went back to Europe. In particular, I went to France, where I did a postdoc with Hans Hermann, who was an expert in statistical physics of fracture, granular media, and so on. And I spent 2 years there working on mostly on fracture phenomena, so how things break, and granular media, so sand and how the sands move. And then after these 2 years, I went back to Rome, where I started as a researcher. And there, as a researcher, I was pretty free to work on many topics. So I still continued working on this kind of phenomena that I was interested in, so materials and their dynamics and their response to external perturbation, so fracture. But then I added more topics like plastic deformation. I studied the vortices in superconductors, a lot of work on magnetic materials. In general, all the common trend about all these topics was the use of statistical physics tools. So to study this subject as a non-equilibrium phenomenon, as a complex system. And so I worked on many of these topics and so on. I think then more recently, I mean, not so recently, but almost 20 years ago, I met Caterina, and I added also, thanks to her, some activity in biological phenomena. But this was mostly driven by her. So I will leave the floor to her to
Right.
discuss why biology is interesting for a statistical physics
Well,
person.
I met complex system, complexity, and this way of thoughts when we together were guest by Jim Settner in Cornell University. Our daughter was just really a newborn, and we were discussing with Jim, and I was telling him what was my story, and I will tell you now my big story before I met Jim. And he said, "Oh, but come on, biology is so important for complexity." And I started to study with him. He's a very good teacher. He's so good teacher. Of course, there is also Stefano, but he's a very good teacher. So I started, to change completely my mind. So my background is in pathology. So I'm a general pathologist. So what is a general pathologist? Because we have this discipline in Italy and in Germany. And is really the roots of medicine. So a general pathologist is someone that is a theoretical medical doctor, I mean, no? Theoretical scientist in medical disciplines. So it's not someone that is working with the subjects, with patients, but starting to understand what are the roots, no? Why the pathologies come from, and so in the theoretical point of view, and starting to understand what is going on in that specific pathologies. That means that I have a wide background in pathologies, in different pathologies, no? I started when I graduated University of Milano. I went to Mario Negri Institute because I was really fascinated at that time in 1991 by brain, so CNS. so, and I started to work in a lab. I was doing experiments on you know, the network of these neurotransmitters, acetylcholine and others were working, and so on. But after, and with connection also with Sweden and other collaborators also in the States. But after a year and a half, something like that, wow, the life was very hard, because I was expecting to be, you know, more comprehensive of what was going on. Actually, my real life was to spend all the life with these little mice, doing these, you know, implants and other stuff. But I didn't have the pictures, what I'm going, what happens, what is happening. I was still publishing other stuff, but very, you know, specific, technical. So that pharmacos is linked to other one. So what we call the signal transduction. So I decided to move, to change. I joined, I started my PhD, so I go back to university. I started a PhD, and I'm starting to work in cancer, so in oncology. That helped me to be more, you know, broad, to study different aspects, even a model, of course, and cells. And I started to deeply studying the possible target in a signal transduction, maybe also some drugs and so on. And this was part of the story, but when I met Jim, I was starting the plasticity of cells, the tumor cells. So starting to come up this idea that the cells is not just something static, so it's left and you have to study how it's made and that's it, but it can change. And there is something really new in the biology, because usually the people think that the change, so the biologist thinks that the change occurs during development, but then that's it, no? Then you have done all your job and the cells is the cells and you specialize in something. It's not like this. In particular, in tumors is a very good example. So I was studying that, and Jim opened up my mind and helped me to understand that I could study, you know, this process, not only with the wet lab, so of course you need to validate and do analysis, but also with other kinds of instruments, also theoretical one. And then is the, you know, we started a lot of projects also with Stefano. Now, nowadays, I have three different, you know, I mean, I don't, it's not just project, but I mean, some three different aspects that I'm studying. The brain that is still there, again, studying the complexity and the interaction of our brain with the environment and with, you know, related to stress, to some kind of pathologies that are very, you know, generalized in our society. Tumors, of course, and in particular, plasticity of tumors and environmental. So the impact of, you know, the environment on our health, well-being, in particular in our cities, is so important. You live in Paris, we live in Milan, so they are crowded, there are a lot of noise, the life is busy, communication. This impacts our health, our well-being, that is much more than health, and this is very intriguing me. I like, we are also working on this.
Okay, interesting. And are you using in all the three verticals the tools, the theoretical tools you mentioned of
in
complex
all
systems,
the
statistical physics, let's say? The now, dialogue is...
Yes, so now it's very nice. And I think that my background in pathologies is very important, because one thing that I understood very well is that the two communities of physics, biomedical, are different. There are different, you know, way to think, actually, because we are trained in a different way. That is true. That is also, you know, helps, doesn't help us to communicate always in the right way. So, and that is important to have someone that, you know, a broad picture, because I understand what is physically important, but also related to something important in the health, from the health point of view. And it's not just a theoretical one, because it's interesting, but it's related to it. But this is important for my community, to communicate to my community, because otherwise they say, oh, but this is, you know, a model. What does it mean? It's just a model. No, it's not a model. It's something that happens in the real life. So that's now the job that we are doing also together.
Yeah, this resonates with some discussions I heard in conference related to physics and econophysics. I mean, finance, physics, and econophysics. about the usefulness or the lack of it of toy models, let's say, of models, of modeling, of a physics approach in
honest, a medical doctor, a biomedical, in general, these people don't trust so much the models. They always say, oh, but this is a model. So you have really do demonstrate them that they are related to what they are studying. So this is also because they are trained in a different way. And to put together the two different communities is very hard. No, Stefano doesn't like to talk with medical doctors because they don't trust him so much. Mm. Say, okay, what he's doing, they don't understand very well if he's starting to, you know, to say, oh, this is criticality. What is this? I don't know. We don't care. On the other hand, he's very bored when these medical doctors just start, you know, to tell them some, I don't know, disease or some factors, a long list that if you are not deep, you know, involved in that specific problem, you don't understand very well, no? When you go to the doctor, I don't know if you understand all the words that you're saying, you're not going back. No, they are trying to say, oh, you have this, but in a complicated way. Maybe it's very simple, but there is this, and this is the important barrier between the patient and the doctors, no? It's very similar in the scientific conversation. So I think to have both knowledge is very, very important. And the future will be like that. So we are trying to have people, students, collaborators that are immersed, you know, deep in both environment, and they're able to, you know, to understand better both worlds.
Nice. Yeah, so you mentioned it a few times, both of you, the concept of complex systems and criticality. So I guess it would be interesting to... You mentioned some examples, avalanches, sand piles, cancer, maybe, I don't know if metastasis in particular is a critical transition or something like that. But can you define it, let's say, in your experience, all the examples you encountered, and in an abstract sense, what is a complex systems and a critical transition?
So maybe I can say a little bit what we think in physics as a complex system is a system that whose behavior, I mean, large scale behavior, we always think, is not really dependent in a simple way from what the individuals are doing. So we have many parts, and then you have a collective behavior. And if we study just a single part, we are not able to understand the collective. So that's what complex systems are. System where the interactions within the part is somehow more important than the behavior of the single. And this is quite important from the physics point of view, because, you know, big part of theoretical physics has focused on the individual, in a sense, so elementary particles. So break down all the systems into pieces and understand in a very detailed way how the pieces work. No? So that's we want to understand the electron, we want to understand the proton, then we want to split the proton into quarks, understand the quarks and so on, and understand the process between them. And then one train of thought traditionally is to say that if we understand the parts very well and we break down everything into pieces, then we understand everything. Then there was another trend that came up in the 70s, and that was that, look, this is of course very important to understand fundamentals of physics, but there is something more that comes from the interactions. And so even if you understand everything about the quantum mechanics of matter, I mean, to the very fine level, this won't help you to understand how a complex material works or how a living system works, because there is more to that. And it's not just a matter that you can get out of elementary details. And so this is, in a sense, the birth of the idea of complexity, is that there are different levels of understandings, and maybe the theory you have at one level is not enough for the higher level and so on. And so maybe you should focus on the level you are interested in, which is maybe, I don't know, interaction between objects and so on. So this is the general idea of complexity. And there was a famous paper by Phil Anderson, a Nobel Prize in physics, who wrote "More is Different." So when you put things together, and he was really focusing on this dichotomy, this was 1972, between the particle physics that was looking at elementary elements and condensed matter physics that was a bit snapped. I mean, saying, okay, condensed matter physics is not fundamental science, it's just almost engineering. And he, as a condensed matter physicist, he got the Nobel Prize, by the way, for but he could have maybe got even more than one Nobel Prize. He was saying, no, we are doing fundamental science as well, and as a fundamental science that has to do with interactions, not anymore with elementary properties. So that's the birth of complexity. So critical phenomena, again, were studied very extensively in the 70s, gave some mathematical tools to study these complex systems. And a critical phenomenon is a transition. So the simple example is changes in properties of matter when you change the temperature. So phase transition between a gas and a liquid. So this could be a phase transition. And some peculiar phase transition are second order phase transitions that are continuous. No? And continuous means that there is a change, very dramatic change, but that happens continuously by changing just the parameter by a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this second order phase transition at the critical point show very complex behavior, typically fractal structures, so scale invariant structure and so on. So structure that looks the same statistically at all scales. And this is something that turns out is very interesting to study nature, because there are many structures in nature that have this property. They are scale invariant, at least to a given extent. And so they look the same at different magnification. If you don't have a ruler, you don't understand where you are, no? If you look at the of a natural structure. And so scientists thought, oh, maybe we can use all this mathematical technology that we have developed to study phase transitions and critical phenomena and use it to understand properties of nature that are more general. Fractal nature of many structures, but then also in time, dynamical structures that are complex and they show scale invariant in time. And so that's how a bit how this field of complexity emerged in the physics community. And then maybe, as already pointed out by Anderson, this was clearly something that would have some applications to biology. And I think that's where biology enters in. And maybe I leave the floor to Catherine to comment on that.
No, exactly. So in biology, it fits very well because, you know, the cells is made by different factors, genes, proteins, and so on, and they are connected to each other. So usually biologists or biomedical people try to find the magic bullet, you know, because it's easy when you have, if you think to have some factors that is super important that you maybe knock out or in any way eliminate, whatever, in some way, wow, maybe the pathologist is done. It's not like that at the end. No, cancer is a very complex, disease. Each disease, if you look at disease, are very complicated. And that's the reason of that is that the cell is robust. So means that the weak point. Otherwise, we are not here talking together. This is something is more smart, no, than we thought in the past. And that's why I really was fascinated by complex system, because there is a very, incredible way to understand the complexity of our cells, and of course the higher order, the interaction. The cells can go up and up, further. But at the level of cells, it is fit perfectly with the plasticity that I mentioned before, because the cells, now we know very well, I spent all my life on this. I mean, we know very well that the cell is not just, it's a state. So the cells living in a specific state and is dependent by the environment. And it happens also to us. We are in a state and we depend by the environment. We can change, we are flexible. Also the cells are flexible, that can change. And you can see very well with the tumors. So when we define a breast cancer, doesn't mean anything to me, because there is an heterogeneity between the tumors. There is, in other words, a specificity of that tumors of that person. And what we are now doing is try to kill that tumor, that cells, using some broad principle that all the cells are using. But of course, sometimes works, sometimes not. So we have an audience, everybody, I think, has some story, that guy worked very well with that treatment, but the other one, no. Why? Because each tumor is different. So that's why we're going on a personalized oncology, try to understand the complexity of that tumor, the heterogeneity of that tumor. And in particular, the cells can change in two different states, the mesenchymal that we call epithelial mesenchymal state. What does it mean? When the cells are in epithelial state, they are very connected to each other. They don't move so much. They have some properties, biological properties. So we can define that state because they express some factors, but they can change. The environment help them to change in a mesenchymal state. And this state is completely different because they are not connected anymore each other. They can move, and this is the cells that can give rise metastasis, or actually they can move, they can go somewhere. This is a simplified model. So we think the good, the bad, the good part and the bad part of the tumors. But we also shown, and now the evidence in the real life, I mean, in the tumors is pretty clear, that is more complicated than this, because the cells exist also in intermediate states. They can be together at the same time, and then. They are in the intermediate states, and these intermediate states, how we define, because they express both markers, markers of epithelial state and markers of mesenchymal. Uh-huh. And what we found, actually, now is evident also in the clinic, so I mean in the tumors, in the real life, these intermediate states are even much more better, so they are much more smarter to give rise to metastasis, even with respect to mesenchymal state.
Okay.
That's actually what we found, that
right.
These are more unstable, and we have to find of course, a way to catch these cells in order to understand what will be the fate of that tumors, what will happen, and the means of that specific patients, what will happen at that one. So we have to catch this specific situation. I don't know if you want to add something, Stefano, if I said
so
that.
To come back to your original question, yes, in this sense, we can see this transition to metastasis as a sort of phase transition. So we wrote with Caterina a comment in Nature Review Physics where we try to discuss this point. So what kind of transition it is? Can we map it to a transition that exists in materials? No?
Mm-hmm.
So can I think we can. So at two levels, at the level of the single cell that changes its state, from mesenchymal to epithelial and vice versa, so they can do both transition. And this is very similar. So what is the state in which this cell lives? Well, this is the state of all the expression of all the genes of the cells. So the
okay. So in your work, the complex system is the single cell, it's not the interaction.
Exactly.
Okay.
Both.
Okay.
There are two transitions at two levels. At the level of the single cell, we imagine a cell, and the cell is a complex system because it's regulated by 20,000 genes that talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then we studied the interaction between these genes, and we saw that, okay, this is an extended system, it's a complex system interacting, and the result of this interaction is a state of the cell. And the state of the cell can change in response to external factors, as Caterina said, the environment. And so there is really a phase transition in this state of the cell. But then there is a second transition that's also interesting. And when you put many cells together, well, these cells together, they also have physical contact and biochemical contact and so on. And they also have a transition as a state of the collective of the cells. And this is a different transition, a different phase transition that is related to other phase transition in matter that we call in physics jamming transition. So a jamming transition you observe in soft matter, in granular media, so in colloids, in systems that are packed together, if they are too packed, they cannot move. But if you leave them room, or if they are active enough, they can move. And cells do the same thing. If they are too compressed and packed, they don't move.
Mm-hmm.
But once they get motile and they find space, they can unjam. So there are these two views of looking at phase transition in cancer. So one single cell based, and another multiple cell based.
Right.
And as I said at the beginning, in a complex system, you have to choose the level at which you study the system. You cannot study everything. So there will be different theoretical and computational models for the two different levels.
Mm-hmm. And your focus, I mean, if you, in terms both of energy you spent on trying to understand one of the two critical transitions, and in terms of trying to argue which one is the driving force for cancer development, I mean, Richard, are you looking into both?
yes, we are looking at both levels, of course, because it's related to, so one of them, the major cause of death now for tumors is not primary tumors, okay, because we can manage primary tumors, but metastasis.
Mm-hmm.
That means that the fate of these cells can be to move and to give rise to secondary tumors in other places. That are very dangerous because we don't have so, strong instrument to kill these cells for many, many reasons. So it's important at this level to predict. So, mm-hmm. I have now a diagnosis of primary tumors, and my question is, okay, what's going to happen at this guy? Is going to be metastatic or not?
Mm-hmm.
And that means to deal with this complexity of the tumors, the heterogeneity and complexity of the cells, and we developed a strategy, Ariadne, that helps us to calculate the risk, of mm-hmm. course, the risk of aggressiveness of that specific tumors with that characteristic, with that complexity of 20,000 genes that are connected in a very complicated way for that person. And this also, of course, a change over time. That's also helps us, to follow the dynamics, of that that subject in some way, no? That is the idea. Stay, I don't know if you want to...
Yes, no, correct. So essentially, we focused on both aspects. So because, of course, both are important. And now Caterina mentioned the first single cell transition, but we also did work trying to understand how the cell moves once they are in the state that they can move, and how they interact with each other, and whether physical barrier can prevent them to move, and so on. So, and also mechanical forces. So we try to have a complete picture, both from the computational model point of view and from experiments, because then Caterina always does the experiment that...
from the second question, the collective migration, the main question is, okay, the cells are moving collective, but in vitro, actually, we can see that not all the cells are moving always together. We have these leader cells. We have some cells that seems to be special and they are moving faster than the others. Mm-hmm. And that is supposed to be the metastatic one because they are moving, maybe detaching from the other cells and go somewhere. And we investigated a lot to this aspect in under, try to understand the mechanics, actually, is more related to what Stefano is, expert on the mechanics of the cells, and of course means the cytoskeleton, on the capability of the cells to change, and why exist these cells, these special cells, are they special or not? This is another question of just by chance some of them are able to go faster. That's some of the questions that are.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to hear you speak. I mean, I don't know if I see the dialogue between the two fields, but I never, I don't see as much between, let's say, dynamical system theory and complex system theory as much as I would like. I don't know, when you talk about criticality, do you think about bifurcating phenomena like as if it was a dynamical system? Do you study chaotic behavior or, I don't know, I see a parallel, but you're not speaking that language.
Exactly, but this is... I think most of trainings that we had. So physicists, they have different schools and different interests. No? So there is a dynamical system school that, of course, focuses on that and has a language, as you mentioned, bifurcation, and more on the critical phenomena school, which looks at collectives. Mm-hmm. So, of course, chaos and dynamical mm-hmm. systems normally are studied with few degrees of freedom, because mm-hmm. That's typical thing, while in critical phenomena we study mostly systems with many degrees of freedom, infinite number of degrees of freedom. So that a bit changes a bit the perspective. But of course, we also use once in a while also dynamical systems tools. For instance, Caterina suggested to study an interesting question about COVID. So why do bats live with COVID? No,
so and. We had this. I thought, why so the bats, they are able to live very well with COVID, because they were, there are a lot of coronavirus and they don't have any problems. So we said, can we understand why? How is possible? And we use this strategy,
So the idea, and it's now we study this as a simple system, not a mm-hmm. complex system,
okay.
Few degrees of freedom, and 1 degree of freedom was the viral load that a bat had,
mm-hmm.
and the other degree of freedom was the immune response of the bat. And then we used some differential equations that would study this the evolution of these two quantities in response to a particular feature of the bath, which is their sleep-wake cycle, which is quite peculiar because their temperature goes up and down by many degrees. You know? And so there are biological data that study and you can use to tune your model about how the temperature changes during the day and the night and so on. And also the immune response changes with temperature, and the viral reproduction curve changes with temperature. Everything changes with temperature. So we constructed this model and studied the phase space in dynamical mm-hmm. system sense of this model. And we found that was interesting because we found a sort of quasi-periodic behavior and made in such a way that whenever the viral response would start to become important, then the immune response would also grow because of this cycle of temperature cycle. And so this would keep the virus always below the threshold of being dangerous. No, they would be, so in this way, we explained why the bats can coexist with these viruses. So, and this is an example where we use some dynamical systems. So of course, depending on the problem, you might use one tool or the other. My personal training, I'm more working with many degrees of freedom systems. So mm-hmm. dynamical systems I use less because that's my mindset. But of course, we know these tools and sometimes they mm-hmm. happen to be used.
Right. So the number of degrees of freedom defines the language barrier that you have to overcome.
I would say yes, because of course, if you have many degrees of freedom, then a statistical approach is more effective than dynamic system approach. So you cannot follow all the trajectories, no?
Yes.
So
that... yes. Yeah. And actually, I started doing my research on traditional dynamical system, let's say low degrees of freedom. But as soon as you introduce uncertainty quantification and robust control, then you have to be able to approximate operators. And so ideally you should be, I mean, you start thinking about ergodic theory and the impossibility to follow so many trajectories. And maybe this also relates to finance. And I would say it's not an accident that this podcast is called Ensemble Podcast, because the ensemble, and then I will jump on the AI question, in the sense that for us, ensemble is interesting both from a statistical perspective and ensemble learning from a machine learning perspective. Maybe you could comment on the relations between the two in your field, and then discuss about, you mentioned Ariadne, the AI tool, the artificial intelligence tool, this is more for Caterina, to calculate what the aggressiveness of cancer, what does it mean? So it's a classification. What is this tool?
I think kind of a classification, because what is fed Ariadne is the transcriptome, is 20,000 genes, so this is a huge connection that happens inside our cells, and considering this complex network from the data of the patients, so of course we can calculate this risk, is a risk of aggressiveness, so we can you know, have an idea of how much that cells are prone to go to a mesenchymal state or intermediate states and move actually and give rise to metastasis. That helps the oncologist to choose the best therapy for that specific cancer, for that specific person, and maybe understand better the management of these of the patients. Because keep in mind that most of the time the patients that we are talking now about breast cancer, so the women are in particular for triple negative breast cancer. Since these cancer,
sorry, what is triple negative?
So is one of the four, you have four different types of breast cancer. One of these is triple negative, is about 20% each in the, you know, statistically present in the population of breast cancer worldwide. And triple negative breast cancer is negative to all the possible, you know, markers that we have, and that we use this marker as a therapy because we have some molecules that can affect these markers and affect the biology of the tumor cells. But since these are triple negatives, they don't have any, so three markers are absent at least, we don't have at the moment a specific drug working for this cancer. That means two things, that the women are often overtreated. So, I mean, the doctor should do something and there are some protocols, and they use the protocols, whatever happens, because they don't know what to do, and it makes sense. But on the other hand, there is an economic issue, of course, because all these treatments are not just for free, it's expensive. And second, another important question is for the women, because when they are under treatment, you have to treat them for secondary effects. I mean, nausea, other effects they have. So you don't have any effect in terms of tumors, and you have other effects that you don't want to avoid. So the idea to have in the future, no, there will probably, we will have a lot of these instruments, tools that can help the oncologist to choose the best way to understand better what is the biology of that specific person, and then decide more, you know, with some scientific, you know, evidence on the background, what kind of therapy, how long, I mean, all these kinds of questions. So Ariadne is an instrument that was not created just for breast cancer, was related to this generic question, can we predict, can we calculate risk for tumors, the primary tumors? So we started with one tumor, we had the data for that tumor, so we started with the triple negative breast cancer. It is a medical device type 2 in EU, so it's available, it's possible to use, and now we are of course scale up with for other kind of tumors, because it's possible to expand and to mm-hmm. generalize. So that's the general idea.
Yeah, so if I can add something, this is a bit a peculiar way of using artificial intelligence, because when you say artificial intelligence, everybody thinks deep learning, machine learning. So essentially, I have a big neural network that doesn't know anything about anything, it's generic, and then you feed in a lot of data, maybe with tags or maybe without tags. So, and then after the machine learns this thing. So this has been attempted for tumors, and has been, I think, a failure. And the reason it's a failure is because you have this famous curse of dimensionality. Mm-hmm. So you are trying to optimize a multidimensional system, so many parameters, essentially. And in the case of the transcriptome, you have 20,000 parameters. Mm-hmm. You're living in a 20,000 dimensional space. And 20,000 dimension is a lot. And so to train effectively 20,000 dimensional parameter space, you need probably billions of cases. No, but mm-hmm. we don't have a billion tumors to mm-hmm. train the data set. So we have maybe 100, or if you're lucky, 1,000. No? So this is clearly very hard. So you overfit for sure, and mm-hmm. maybe you get something, but most of the time it's not working. So we are not using, Ariadne doesn't use this kind of strategy, so it's not a generic neural network. It's a more sophisticated approach that leverages what we already know about tumors. So we know that there are genes, that these genes are not random variables. They are interacting with well-defined pathways, which people have studied for decades. And so we use this information and to make a more informed decision. So it's artificial intelligence in a sense. It gives you a classified answer mm-hmm. based on the data, but it's not a neural network.
Mm. Yeah, because at the moment, you know, in the medical, actually, in biomedical research, we don't have millions of data. So the data are rare and very, very mm-hmm. small. And also the quality, because we always deal with hospitals and the quality is not so good. It takes a while, no? There is a training that we have to do also with the people that manage this data, how to get it, mm-hmm. lots of stuff. So at the moment, it's not possible to do this kind. It's just because I read a lot of papers claiming I do this artificial intelligence, but at the end, they cannot predict anything because it's not going to work. We don't have enough data. It's mm-hmm. a lot
mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, this resonates a lot with the work we're doing in finance. You know, as you said, the space is highly dimensional. You don't have much data because history, I mean, you have sparse observations in time in the past for many reasons, and also the quality is an issue. And maybe if I can ask you, in general, not only Ariadne, but how do you deal with how do you not overfit? How do you deal with a model that's robust, that can do a can give you an uncertain quantification on the classification, and if you use ensembling techniques to do this.
Yes, so that's of course is a crucial issue, how not to overfit. In our case, we rely on the, not so much on training, as I said, a neural network, mm-hmm. but on previous knowledge and so on. And so then is really we don't really train the
okay.
the
and
the
this knowledge is in terms of priors in a statistical sense.
Exactly, some sort of okay. knowledge that is accumulated and that we trust is correct and that we have seen in the literature and so on. So biological knowledge, if you want, it's not just data science, but
is this a statistical? Are you informing the statistical?
In a sense, yes. So
we are using
some structure that we think is correct and so on, and so this makes it, in our opinion, more robust. But of course, there is always uncertainty, you know, in this, and so that's why we never say that we give. Yes, no answer. No, we give a risk. No, so then and this is supported, then validated with the data. No, and the more data we get, the more sure we can be that this risk is well evaluated. So it's an evolving world, but it's true that it's not strictly all this machine learning thing is never really strictly. You can try to get some bounds about your confidence level, but it's always very hard, no? Because you might be completely biased, no? in your data set, and then you think that you're okay, and then some new data set comes that's completely different because your previous data set had a bias, and yeah, so I'm always a bit skeptical about people say that, okay, I have precision of 99% mm-hmm. and so on. Okay, you have on this particular training set that you got, but then it can always be wrong.
Yeah, definitely. So I had one question about into optimal control, let's say. How is the interaction between this tool, let's say, and the doctor in the development of the optimal cure?
You need a lot of patience, because the people have to be, you know, knowledge about what we are doing, because they are just thinking, okay, artificial intelligence, we're pushing a button or something, you know. It's an hard work. It's important to be, you know, a doctor as well, so to talk with them in the same language. But I'm thinking about Italy, that the situation I think is not so good, because of the artificial intelligence in general. No, I mean, this use of big data, in particular in the hospitals. Okay, there are a lot of claims, but we are really, you know, at the beginning, so there is a huge distance. Because the people use, in my world, think about bioinformatics, but it's something completely different. So, I mean, bioinformatics is someone that push a button and is not able to change anything what he's using, and is a tool that he bought somewhere. I mean, that's the level. In another part of the world, it's going to be better, but still, it takes a while, you know, to... So the interaction is not so easy, it's complicated, but now, after... 4 years, because we started this job, because it's working so well. So I think that the people should use. That's just one reason, not so much commercial or other stuff. I want that the people use, because it's working. And now after 4 years, and you know, we are really, you know, starting to see something. The people trust us and starting to understand that they need an help. Also, this is important. They need an help. And they see some option, no?
Yes. So I think I would say that the doctor will always be the one who makes the decision, and what this AI tool can offer is some extra advice, no? Because mm-hmm. anyway, the doctor takes many data, no? Yep. He has seen this, has seen the histology, has seen the patients visited, and so on. And so I think will never be automatic. No, it's just an additional information for the doctor to make a decision based on everything what he says. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, the fair thing to say. So there would be no, as Caterina said, no magic bullet. Mm-hmm. It's just an ongoing investigation.
Yeah. And doctors will keep their job also.
Exactly.
Yes, yes. I see. I wanted to go back to complex systems. Also, I wanted to ask maybe Stefano a question about, you also mentioned you studied in Rome, so I'm curious about whether you ever interacted with Giorgio Parisi. But I wanted to ask about, the Physics Nobel Prize of 2021, if you see it coming in some way. I think I saw it arrive on LinkedIn from your side, let's say. In my network, yeah. I saw it coming from...
Yes, so of course, so I knew Giorgio Parisi. When I was a student, he was professor in Tor Vergata, so I didn't follow his courses and so on, but then he moved to La Sapienza, and so I had the chance to discuss with him sometimes. We were in the same center, research center, mm-hmm, if you want. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was a very good for Italian science and for Italian physics in general to have the Nobel Prize to Giorgio Parisi, because it demonstrated that you can have great science and great physics in a country like Italy, which is something that people know, because if you look around, you see Italians in all the physics department in the world, not only Italians, but people maybe who got the PhD in Italy and study in Italy. And Giorgio Parisi, he spent essentially all of his career, except maybe a couple of small postdocs and outside, in Italy and in Rome. So he's not an American-trained scientist. He's a scientist that has been trained, worked in Italy all his life, and he was able to reach the top of the field. So in this, I think it's a big thing for Italy, which is always looked upon a bit like as a second... degree scientific country. So I say, okay, they're good, the Italians are good, but in Italy you cannot do science. And I think this was the proof that you can do science, you can do top science. So I was very happy for that, because really showed, really demonstrated that that we can do it, and we have done it, and he has done it. And I think a big example for our students and for all the research community in Italy. So I was very happy for that. And
did you see it coming? That's my question.
Okay, so let's say this. When I was a student, everybody was saying, okay, Parisi will get the Nobel Prize. So this is something that I heard all my life. But you know, these people say, because of course he was brilliant, always brilliant and so on. But you can never count on that. So in a sense, that's something that was a bit of a surprise, I think, because... Okay, people say it, but then to get it is another thing. Also, because coming from Italy, I mean, if he maybe was professor in the U.S., maybe people would have expected it more. You know? Because it happened many times that researchers in Italy who clearly deserved the Nobel Prize didn't get it. I don't know for what reason, but so there is sort of this feeling that. You have less chances, because we have less prestige, you know, and prestige is important in science.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have to say, the good papers of Parisi, I don't understand them, but I had the chance to understand and enjoy the work with Benzi about stochastic resonance in climate. So I don't know. I would like to ask both about, let's say, those kind of toy models which are low degrees of freedom but still show some behavior which are not traditionally dynamical system. Correct me if you agree with this, but stochastic resonance is an example. And do you encounter something like that in biology? Maybe in the brain dynamics. I read something shallowly about it. If you can.
Yeah, I think toy models are very, very useful. In a sense, of course, they are abstractions, and nobody would believe their exact reality exactly works like that. But I think it gives you a feeling, and maybe can reveal something that at the beginning you didn't expect. Mm-hmm. So so you look at it, you construct the model, you can understand everything about the model, and sometimes you get surprised. And when you get surprised, this means that the model maybe has shown some phenomena that it's interesting. And then you can go back and look at more complex models and more realistic models and say, okay, maybe this surprise is still there and I can explain it. No? So that's the theoretical physics of, in a sense, toy model. toy models, and sometimes toy models are quantitatively correct. And okay, we with Caterina we constructed many. Our first work together was a toy model of these cancer stem cells, and it worked. I mean, it's very simple model. It was not a dynamical system model. Was a let's say a probabilistic model, but gave excellent agreement with the experiments that Caterina made. And also made predictions that were interesting. So I'm very much in favor of toy models. I mean, if you start to put everything into your model, then maybe you can reproduce reality, but you cannot understand it. Mm-hmm. So we would like to understand, not only reproduce. I mean, reproducing, it's okay. If you put everything in, you get what you want. But the question is, can we understand the core? Can we throw away all the stuff that is not needed and keep what we really explain the phenomenon? So that's a bit what theoretical physicists try to do.
That's why we started with a very simple model, no? With a very toy model, because we wanted to understand how it was going on. And also with Jim Sekna, no? We modify a little bit the model, and we introduce the idea of senescence, so cells that mm-hmm. are not dying, but they are not quiescent, but they are just going to die, but not yet dying. And no, we found that changing a little bit the model, we got very, you know, realistic data, actually, results.
Yeah. And then, I mean, inspired by the model, then Caterina could go to the lab and say, okay, let me do this experiment in this way and see if what the model, the toy model, suggests is true. And it turned out to be true. Mm-hmm. Notice that this is completely at odds with what biologists do. No, there was a famous paper in biophysics, I don't know if very famous, but was arguing about the fact that theory in any biological paper, if it's there, and now in more and more papers there is some theory, like modeling and so on, it's always figure 8 and at the end of the paper, mm-hmm. no, like an addendum. No? While in physics, often theory is page 1 and figure 1, and then comes the experiment. No? Yeah. And then a revolution in the biology or biomedicine mindset is to have theory first. No, sometimes, no, because maybe you learn something and then you guide the experiment. This, of course, never happens. No, and Caterina would say it would never happen.
No, that's very impossible at the moment. For the last 10 years, at least, I don't know. Yeah, but that experiment was very hard because I mean, I didn't. Since I saw the theory, no, I said, okay, we can figure out an experiment.
The theory, you mean the toy model?
Yes, with the toy model, I say, okay, now we figure out the experiments. Because it was a very, very long experiment. So, I mean, it took almost a year. So, I mean, to start an experiment, to start a year, and to do every day something, because it was not just, you know, leave there, recess, and forever. You know, you have to be very convinced, you know, that it's going to work or it's going to do, you know, something, actually. And then also, it was very hard, that experiment.
Right. And about the tools you use in statistical physics, I mean, how much of the language you developed in statistical physics are you using in your collaboration in terms of crackling noise, stochastic resonance, critical transition? How much of it is there?
Because when it's not expected, we are not looking at that, but come up. And Stefan is so happy, saying, look, this is cracking noise. This is, but we are not looking at that. This is biology, so this is physics, not that.
Yeah, there was a nice example when we were in Helsinki with Caterina. And Caterina had this experiment of these cells, cancer cell that were moving in a wound healing experiment. So these wound healing experiments, they plate the cell and then they create a scratch, so like a wound cell, and the cell starts to move. No? Yeah. And then we were looking at this data and it looked very much like a crack front. That's why I said crack. What is a crack? It's a crack is a fracture path between material. So you create a crack and then you pull out the material and the crack starts to move. And people had done experiments in which they were imaging this crack. No? And well, I study this because this crack moves in avalanches. So it makes bursts. Sometimes it's stuck and then moves and stuck and moves and makes a crackling noise. No? And the result is a crackling noise. And by looking at the cells, it looks exactly like the crack, although these are cells and there is no stress pushing them and so on. Then we used the same tools that we were using to analyze the cracks, exactly the same software and so on. And then we found avalanches, and the avalanches were complex. They had power law distributions, and this created a really long and extensive work on how this cell invade. No, and it turned out that it popped up by chance, in a sense. No, we were not looking for it, and so.
The interesting part of biology point of view is that we change the adhesion molecules, the capability of the cells to stay together, to stick together. And this is very comprehensible in my world, but when I try to present the, you know, the presence of these cracking noise and avalanche, the people don't follow me anymore. So it's very hard that I don't have any chance to present this data in a biological conference or meetings because they didn't have any, you know, mm-hmm. comments or understandable. It's not understandable for them. So that's because Stefano can present in the physics and maybe they don't care about adhesion molecules, whatever. Mm-hmm. But the two different worlds that I try to combine. No?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I had a last question. I don't know if we want to go into that one, but I read somewhere in your works that you are dealing with non-Markovian systems. So this, I guess to close, I have this really technical question.
Okay, so
about
I can
non-Markovian processes.
My non-Markovian processes. So, of course, there are often these dynamics of the system Markovian is in the sense that the dynamics at time t depends only on the dynamics at the previous time or very. Mm-hmm.
Everything we talked up to now is Markovian in the sense avalanche phenomena.
Not always. Now I gave you an example. Most of the models that we use for avalanche phenomena are in a sense Markovian. In a sense, the velocity at a given time depends on the force at that time. Okay, so they are overdamped system, and then of course every time the force changes, and so the velocity can increase, and so on, and so you get fluctuations, and so on. So this is most. And one classical example of crackling noise that I've studied for decades. Is the noise emitted by ferromagnets when they are magnetized. So and you essentially take a piece of iron, put a wire around it, add a magnetic field, and then the wire starts to crackle. So you hear noise. Mm-hmm. And this we understood with models of domain walls moving. No? So the domain walls are the interfaces between positive magnetization and negative magnetization. When you magnetize, the negative magnetization turns up, and so the domain wall moves, and by moving, sometimes it finds obstacles and then creates this cracking noise. Mm-hmm. So this is the general thing. So we had very sophisticated models that could try to understand this. And we were looking at this data and fitting the model to the experiments. The experiments were done very precisely by my colleague Gianfranco Durin in Torino. He was very precise in doing this experiment. So we looked at everything, and we could understand with the model almost everything. But then there was something strange, because the model would predict that this burst, no, these pulses, no, this voltage pulse in this wire would go up and then go down, no, mm-hmm. and more or less symmetrically. So go up and then goes down, and the shape was more or less symmetric, statistically speaking. Mm-hmm, no? This is what the model would predict. But then the experiment were always leftwards asymmetric. And then we said, how is possible? We have very sophisticated theory that understands everything, that's able to show that exponents, distributions, everything matched with the theory, except this tiny detail. So that the shape of this pulse was asymmetric in the experiment and was symmetric in the model. And so then we realized that we had missed something. And what we missed was the so-called eddy currents. So what are eddy currents? Is when you magnetize a conductor, like typically ferromagnets are metals, so they are conductors. When the domain wall moves, it induces currents called eddy currents. Okay. I like more the Italian word with correnti parassite, so parasite currents. So they really shouldn't be there, but they are there. And these currents, they dissipate energy. So, and they're part of the damping of the domain wall. Now, the problem is that we, in our theory, we didn't put up we didn't consider the fact that once you excite these eddy currents, they continue running, no? They don't die out immediately. So the force on the wall at a certain time is not only due to the magnetic fields at that time, but it's also due to what happened before, because right. the wall has moved before and has excited these currents, and these currents now stop the wall moving or interact with the world. And so this is a non-Markovian effect in some sense, mm-hmm. so some memory of the past. Mm-hmm. And now when we included this non-Markovian effect in our model, by sort of miracle, the asymmetry became leftwards. Mm-hmm. And then the interesting thing is that then Gianfranco and some colleagues in Brazil, they say, okay, can we remove this eddy currents? And they find a way. So basically take a very thin sample so the currents cannot propagate so much. Mm-hmm. There,
the experiments recover
the symmetry. So that's an example where you always work with the Markovian models that have no memory, and then you find some physical phenomena that you cannot explain. And then you say, okay, then I have to use this annoying non-Markovian property that mm-hmm. we have to get rid.
Do you have an example also in biology, let's say, of things like this, yeah. of memory? I mean, Catherine mentioned the importance of environment. I don't know if...
But I guess... I guess that's always
not clear.
We don't have now an example, but I imagine there should be. No, like I imagine neuroscience.
Neuroscience from a different perspective. I disagree with many of the literature that are already present. So I don't know at the moment, but we are working with a different mindset. So let's see. So I don't believe in this, but I don't want to say because maybe this is too much. It's my opinion, so I'm working on this. So it's okay.
You have a bias. We mentioned bias. You're building on a bias. Not worth it.
But okay. Of course, in many systems, memory is important, and you cannot just neglect it. So mm-hmm. of course, for simplicity, you'd like to have no memory, but sometimes it's memory is there.
Yeah. I guess we can close on this one. Sorry for the last technical question, but it was a pleasure to meet you, to talk to you. And I see your collaboration as a virtuous example of how fundamental science and experiments—I don't know how to call it—applicative science, experimental science—can and need to dialogue. And I don't know. It looks great to look.
Thank you so much.
We have a lot of fun doing it. So
I can feel it talking to you.
Yes. So. The philosophy is to have fun. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot.